Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will talk to an expert about the recent measles outbreak. He'll also talk with someone about the abuse of youths in Ohio's inpatient care facilities. And he'll chat with an expert who says it's best to file your taxes earlier than later. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
There are 483 cases of measles in the U.S., and 10 of them are here in Ohio. The Ohio Department of Health says they're all in Ashtabula County, but an infected individual exposed others in Knox County and Central Ohio. All infected cases were from unvaccinated individuals. Ohio's vaccination rate has dropped, and it now trails behind the national average. Dr. Tina Tan with Children's Hospital of Chicago joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about causes, prevention, and treatment. Welcome to Columbus Perspective.
Thank you so much.
What causes measles?
So measles is caused by the measles virus. And the measles virus is the most contagious virus that can be transmitted in a setting.
So why is it so contagious?
So basically, it is so contagious because it only takes a small amount of the virus to basically cause an infection. And when you look at the contagiousness of measles, the reproductive number of the organism is called R0, which represents the average number of people who will contract an infection from one person with the disease. And measles has the highest R0 at 12 to 18, which means that an infected person with measles, on average, can infect 12 to 18 other susceptible individuals.
How is it transmitted?
So measles is transmitted via the air. It's an airborne disease. So when a person has measles, the measles virus is in the respiratory droplets. And these droplets can be transmitted when an infected person coughs, sneezes, or even breathes, and the virus can remain infectious in the air or on surfaces for up to 2 hours. So if others breathe the contaminated air or they touch the infected surface and then they touch their eyes, noses, or mouths, they can actually become infected.
What are the symptoms that we should look for?
So measles is it's a respiratory virus, and basically the initial symptoms start with fever, cough, runny nose, and redness of the whites of the eyes, called conjunctivitis. And this is then followed 3 to 5 days later by the development of a red blotchy rash that starts on the face, usually around the hairline, and then spreads down the body and out the extremities. And prior to the development of the rash, patients can also develop whitish lesions on their oral mucosa across from the molars that are known as coplic spots. And people are contagious from 4 days prior to the time that the rash develops through 4 days after the appearance of the rash, with immunocompromised individuals being contagious for a much longer period of time.
So how do you treat it?
So measles, there is no treatment for measles. There's no licensed antiviral agent to treat it. Treatment is supportive.
Okay, so explain what that means to me. Like, when you say supportive, does that just mean rest and fluids and wait it out?
Correct. Exactly. Supportive means rest. It means adequate fluid intake, because some people with measles can have nausea, vomiting, and severe diarrhea.
Can you get the measles if you had the MMR vaccine as a child?
Absolutely. You can get measles or you can be exposed to measles, but most individuals will, if they are going to develop symptoms, they would be very, very mild symptoms.
And eventually the symptoms dissipate and go away, correct?
They go away very rapidly, yes.
Why are vaccines so critical, and who is most at risk, children or adults or senior citizens?
So with the first question, vaccines are critical because they provide protection and prevent an individual from getting measles, which is, it can be a very serious disease. And the vaccines that we use today are very safe and very effective. One dose of vaccine provides 93% protection. Two doses of vaccine that are appropriately spaced provides 97 to 100% protection to that individual from getting measles. So basically, that is the only way and is the most important tool for protecting individuals in the community against getting measles.
So I'm 56 years old, and I had my MMR when I was, you know, an infant, like most most babies. Do I or others who are seniors need to get a booster?
So it's not really a booster. So what happened was, at the time you got your vaccine, only one vaccine was recommended. And then in 1989-1990, there was a very large measles outbreak that occurred in the United States. And it was basically found at that time that the vaccine that was given prior to that time period, where you only got one dose, some of the immunity had waned. So after that very large outbreak in the U.S., it was basically recommended that two doses of MMR vaccine be given on a routine basis. And when you talk about individuals that are at the greatest risk for, you know, getting measles and getting severe disease, these are kids under 5 years of age, especially those under 1 year of age, pregnant individuals, unvaccinated adults over 20 years of age, and persons with underlying immunocompromising conditions, and individuals that are elderly. These individuals are at the highest risk for developing severe disease.
We want to thank Dr. Tina Tan for sharing her thoughts and expertise on this matter. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan. You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Last year, we spoke to Disability Rights Ohio about their 16-month investigation into youth intensive services, a residential facility in Northeast Ohio that stood accused of abusing those receiving treatment and services as inpatients. The investigation resulted in the facility relinquishing its Class 1 Ohio MHAS license and effectively shuttering residential operations there. The problem of abusing disabled individuals, and more specifically disabled youth, persists. And Disability Rights Ohio CEO Sherson Schoberg joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss the issue of critical access authority. It is good to talk to you again, Sherson.
Great talking to you as well, Jay.
Let's start at the beginning. Why are the disabled, and more particularly disabled youth, targets for abuse?
So there's a couple of factors. Whenever an individual is really dependent on someone else for care, that increases their risk of abuse. And many people with disabilities find themselves in that position, whether it's a need for, you know, activities of daily living, or if it is, you know, for children, they're legally dependent on others for decision making. And then when you add on to that a residential setting that is more segregated from the community, cut off from ties to family, for example, which many of the youth that are in residential treatment facilities are in children's services custody and don't have strong ties to their family anymore. You sort of increase that even further because you've taken away the natural advocacy supports that you might have in your life as a whole, right? So those factors come together and make it easier and for children to be targeted for abuse and harder for the children themselves to be able to protect themselves against that.
What is critical access authority and what will that allow DRO to do?
So when Congress created the Protection Advocacy System program, which is the program that Disability Rights Ohio operates today, they created it back in 1970s because in part there was a need to have an independent advocate that could go where people with disabilities are, talk to them privately about the concerns that they had, and then advocate and raise those concerns with people that could take action on it. And that access authority has been built into the federal statutes that created the program, and it's part of what allows Disability Rights Ohio to do that critical role, to do our job, to go where children are and talk to them. Whether they're in children's services custody or still in family custody, they're allowed to speak with us privately, share their concerns. We maintain their confidentiality, and then we work with the facility to try to make changes if possible, or if that doesn't work, we can take those concerns to the licensing bodies to try to get change made at that level as well. And that access authority, though, is what allows us to know about the concerns in the first place, right? If we weren't able to go to where people with disabilities or children with disabilities were and hear from them in a private and safe way, we wouldn't be able to raise these concerns like we did at youth intensive services.
So let's say, hypothetically, I'm now the executive director of one of these facilities. What should I do first when concerns of abuse or neglect are raised?
So first of all, take them seriously, right? Sometimes there's a tendency to not believe children or to not, not take seriously what they're saying. And so, you know, take it seriously, regardless of what your own opinions are on it. You know, do your due diligence, make sure you're doing an appropriate investigation, and make sure that you're offering support, especially if the allegations are very serious, right? That you're offering supports that the child might need if they've experienced some sort of a trauma, even if you haven't determined whether that trauma occurred or not. And have a system that allows for that investigation to occur in a safe and somewhat independent way, right? You know, many facilities are required to have some sort of client's rights focused staff person. So make sure that that client's rights person is known to the youth in the facility, that they know they can go there and talk to them safely and confidentially, and that they are able to effectively do their job somewhat independently, right, from the rest of the leadership, so that they can truly look at the concerns as they're coming through. And then lastly, if you have any kind of reporting requirements, make sure you're following those immediately, whether that's reporting to Children's Services instances of abuse, whether it's reporting to their some other guardian, or reporting to a licensing agency. There are certain types of incidences and allegations that have to be reported up through to the licensing body. Make sure you're doing that as well, because that adds another layer of transparency and it helps make sure that there's advocacy in place for kids when they need it.
Now, you mentioned patient rights advocates. What mm-hmm. rights do patients or even caregivers have, and does it vary based on the location of care?
It absolutely can vary a lot based on the type of licensure that the facility has. There's different rules for different types of settings. But in general, you know, people are entitled to be safe, right? To not experience abuse, to get the level of treatment and care that that place is supposed to provide, right? That they have been licensed to provide, that they're being paid by whatever source it is, whether it's Medicaid or Children's Services or private funding to provide. They have a right to get to that treatment. And they oftentimes will have rights to some level of communication with others, but that can be limited depending on the facility and the situation. One of the things that they do retain a right, though, at almost any type of facility in Ohio is to contact Disability Rights Ohio. And many places, in fact, have to have our information posted so that individuals know that they can contact us. And even if they might have limited phone access to other places or people, they have to be allowed to contact us in many instances.
So when will you know if you are granted critical access authority? What's the next step for DRO?
So the way that it works for us is we have a couple of different ways that we will go out and use our access authority to find out what's happening with children or adults with disabilities. We can go and do what's called a monitoring, which is not complaint-based, and we do that at a wide range of places across the state of Ohio every single year, usually try to get to between 40 and 60 different places to find out what's happening and talk to individuals about their concerns, if they have any. Sometimes we'll do a monitoring visit, and there aren't any really concerns to follow up on, which is great. And then the other way that we can use our access authority is complaint-based, and that's more of an investigation process. And that can be based on a person calling us and sharing a concern that we then follow up on. It could be based on a facility reporting to a licensing body an incident, and we looking at those reports that come in to, say, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. It could be a news report, right, about a problem at a facility. So there's lots of different ways that we can receive a complaint and then follow up through an investigation.
Well, and that makes you guys the watchdog.
It does, but our resources are quite limited, right? Our team that does this type of work is only 4 to 5 people in full-time staff that can do this work across the state of Ohio. So we really can't take the place of the work that licensing bodies should do on a day-to-day basis for oversight and the job that facilities should do with their clients' rights officers or similar position. But we do try to come in where we think that there's a serious concern and that we can make a difference, especially if it doesn't look like it's being acted upon by the facility or the licensing body.
Sherston Schoberg with Disability Rights Ohio, thanks for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
Tax day is Tuesday, April 15th. Certified public accountant and tax expert Lisa Green Lewis from Intuit TurboTax joins us now on Columbus Perspective and says we should not wait to file. And I got to tell you, Lisa, first of all, welcome. Second of all, I get made fun of in my family every year because as soon as that window's open, I'm there. But there are members of my family who wait to the very last minute, and it's exasperating. How can I encourage my family members to stop procrastinating?
Well, first, they should think about the refund. So last tax season, the average refund was over $3,000, and that's more money than some people get in a check all year.
That's a down payment on a new car.
Yes. So, yeah, they should definitely be encouraged to file as soon as possible.
What last-minute tips can you offer to people planning to file their taxes before the 15th of April? Because I know that a lot of people just can't get it together until the 14th.
Well, first, they should e-file with direct deposit. That's the fastest way to get your tax refund. And then gather all your documents in one place. So documents that report your income, like W-2s and 1099s, and then also forms and receipts for those deductible items. You definitely don't want to miss those.
I have used the TurboTax service once or twice in my lifetime, and I've always found that particular exercise of step-by-step helps me maximize my opportunities. But whether they use your service or not, what tips do you have for people filing to actually maximize that potential refund? Because $3,000 sounds great.
Yeah, there's a few tax benefits that I want to highlight. So first, about 90% of filers can claim the standard deduction, and that was increased for inflation. So if you're single, it's $14,600. Married filing jointly, $29,200. And if you can claim head of household, it's $21,900. If you have kids, there's so many deductions and credits that you can get. So the child tax credit, that's up to $2,000 for each of your kids under 17. Or if you sent them to daycare or even summer camp, you may be able to claim the child and dependent care credit. And that is up to $1,050 for one child and up to $2,100 for two or more kids. And then also the earned income tax credit. A family with three kids can claim a credit up to $7,830.
Now, this may seem like a joking question, but I'm not joking. Why is there not a tax credit for people who have pets? We spend so much money on our animals, and they serve a great purpose in terms of mental health and security in the house. Why has there never been a pet tax credit?
Yeah, that's true. So many people ask that, and the IRS just does not consider them as humans. They can't have a Social Security number. So, unfortunately, you cannot deduct your pets, but there are some ways, you know, if you have one that helps you as a service animal, then you may be able to deduct them as a medical expense, or if you are a pet influencer. So pet influencers are able to deduct their pets.
Now, what happens if you owe money? Do you have to pay it all at once, or their payment plans? What do you do?
Yeah, if you owe money, first of all, I would say file. That's another reason to file as soon as possible so that you know how much you're going to owe and you can plan. And then you don't need to pay that until the tax deadline. And then also the IRS, they will allow you to pay what you owe over 6 years with an installment agreement.
What if I'm a complete idiot and I don't know how to follow directions? Is there an opportunity for extra guidance?
Yes, so with TurboTax, we make it easy. You can file, whether you want to do your taxes yourself or hand your taxes over to a tax expert, we have done-for-you filing experiences. And then we have thousands of TurboTax Live experts ready to file your taxes now, and they can do your taxes in as little as a day.
Now, some of those services are free, but others cost money, right?
Right. With an expert, it's going to cost money. But if you have a simple 1040 form and you can have some credits for your kids, you can file for free with our TurboTax Free Edition. And about 37% of filers are eligible for that.
And I also know that some local libraries, some county social service organizations, and the AARP are also services that offer tax help if you need it. But if we want to look into TurboTax more, is there a website?
Yes, you can go to TurboTax.com.
That's easy enough. Lisa Green-Lewis, thank you so much for being with us. And I know you're going to be busy for the next few weeks.
Yes, thank you for having me.
For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Today, our focus is once again on the race for governor. The primary may be more than a year away, but the race itself is well underway. Last Sunday, I interviewed Republican candidate Heather Hill. This week, my guest is the lone Democratic candidate so far, Dr. Amy Acton. Dr. Acton became well known for helping to guide Ohioans through the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic as the director of the Ohio Department of Health. She stood with Governor Mike DeWine in the frequent news conferences about the virus's impact on the state and the response to the virus. According to her campaign website, after serving in the DeWine administration, Dr. Acton returned to the Columbus Foundation and helped found the Center for Human Kindness. She lives in Bexley with her husband, Eric. Together, they have six kids. This is her first run for public office. We'll talk with her in just a minute. On the Republican side, three candidates have entered the race so far. They are former presidential candidate and biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy. Current Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost is now serving his second term in office. And Morgan County small business owner and former president of the Morgan Local School Board, Heather Hill. Governor Mike DeWine cannot run for re-election because of term limits. Joining me now is Democratic candidate for Ohio governor, Dr. Amy Acton. Dr. Acton, thank you so much for being
here
today.
Thank you for having me.
I got to start just with, why did you decide to run for governor?
Well, you know, I had the honor and a privilege of serving, as you said, 11.7 million Ohioans alongside a governor, learned so much about this work. But I also formed a bond in COVID, and everywhere I've gone since, all over this state, people are sharing with me their struggles, what they're facing, and also their ideas for change. And I'm running for governor because I refuse to look the other way. While our state continues to go backwards on nearly every measure, we know it's time for a change.
Now, you're running as a Democrat, but how would you describe your political philosophy?
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I am a doctor. I am not a politician, as you mentioned. My last race was student council president in high school, which I did win.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But, you know, I've spent my whole career as a problem solver and a public servant, certainly working with people on both sides of the aisle, because problems do not care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, they just need solved. And what Ohioans are telling me is that they're looking for public servants. They're looking for people who put our common good ahead of everything, that quit pitting us against one another. They want to see common sense problem solving, which, of course, Ohioans got to know me doing that alongside Governor DeWine. And they want common purpose and common good again.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, you know, with that experience of going through COVID, such a tense time, a frightening time, what did you take away from that experience that you believe could help you as governor?
You know, a lot of folks have looked at our leadership, the governor and I, during that time. And I have to tell you, it was an honor of a lifetime to serve in a moment like that. And, you know, it was an unprecedented crisis we faced. Our main priority was, of course, saving lives. Mm-hmm. But we were also very focused on getting us back to work and getting us back to life as soon as possible. And what Ohioans should know is I'm very proud of what we did together. We saved lives. We flattened the curve. It's actually, we have good data now that shows that. We lost more people in this country than all wars combined, all disasters combined with wars. And if you went in the ICU in March of 2020, a 50% chance of dying. Mm-hmm. By June, after just those few months, we'd gotten that down to 5%. But I can tell you, they said we led differently. And they talked a lot about the way I solve problems, which is being honest, putting the cards on the table, because I really needed Ohioans to lead everywhere they sat. Mm-hmm. I asked more of people, the governor and I asked more of people every day, and certainly Ohioans rode. I always say nothing I would have done would have saved those lives. It was really what we did together. Ohioans had heroism everywhere, and I hear those stories everywhere I go.
Can you describe the pressure of that situation, not only making the decisions about masks and closures and things like that, but the protesters that you faced at your own home and things like that? How intense was the pressure?
You know, we were getting ready for COVID in January of 2020. So we had been doing all of government tabletop exercises as we saw this threat coming around the world. You are so focused. I can tell you that I fell in love with Ohioans during that time. You can't want to save lives and not do everything you can every hour. So that was the focus. And yes, there were protests. We know the hate was real. There were anti-mask societies even back in 1918 in the Spanish flu. That was all anticipated in George W. Bush's playbook that had been passed from president to president. But, you know, the honor was we brought the best and the brightest around the table daily, hourly, solving problems that had never been solved before. I can tell you that that is a blueprint for how I've solved everything with the governor, even and all my work prior to that. We did an opiate settlement by using the same problem-solving technique. We worked on PFAS in our water supply. We worked on a Legionella outbreak in a local hospital. We worked on energy issues. The privilege of being a governor is that it is your job to get folks around the table and have the hard decisions and the hard conversations. And that's something I learned a privilege of learning next to a governor and would bring to this job.
And I'll talk about politics and the race in a second, but a lot of people were wondering, why did you ultimately step down from the role?
Thank you for asking that. You know, the media didn't get it quite right on that. A lot was said about the protesters. People need to understand that we had security issues from the very first day you saw me on TV. All of that was real. But the real reason I stepped down was Larry Householder and some folks in the State House once again wanting some special interests, special orders written that weren't based in the science and quarantine powers. Ultimately, you know, I told the governor I would continue to advise him, and I have ever since continued to advise him on health issues. But I couldn't sign my name to something that I knew would harm Ohioans. 2 weeks later, we know that he was arrested in the largest scandal in Ohio's history. And I think that's one of the problems we face in our state is over many, many years, special interests, bad actors have had way too much influence instead of solving problems that Ohioans face every day.
Well, let's talk about that, too. What do you see as your top priority? What issue really hits home with you?
Well, I can tell you what I'm hearing from Ohioans. I have been going around the state in the years since, and I plan to be going around the state. We're doing a more formal rollout in end of April to listen. But what I can tell you they are saying so far is top of mind is costs. Mm-hmm. People are working hard. They're working harder than they ever have, and they're still struggling to find enough breathing room, whether it's child care. It's certainly eggs and gas that we hear about.
Right.
But they're talking about aging in place and their property taxes not outpacing them. They're talking about being able to afford medicines, child care, schools. Public school is top of mind for folks all over the state. In rural areas and small towns, we don't recognize that 70 of our 88 counties only have public schools, and folks are very concerned about changes there. And people are talking about safety and being able to start businesses and thrive here. So I'm very focused on the things that we hold dear on both sides of the aisle and getting to solving the real pragmatic problems.
There's a lot of discussion right now about the budget proposals and funding for education, and then there's also the issue of vouchers that can be used for private schooling. Where do you stand on that?
You know, not everyone knows the backstory of my life, but I had a really tough childhood. I grew up in Youngstown, ended up in a tent in the middle of winter, a lot of abuse and neglect, moved 18 times before I was 12.
Wow.
And public schools help save my life. They are the thing that gives you a chance. No matter where you start out, we don't get to choose the accident of our birth. Schools, libraries, I think, are the great things that we have done collectively. We invented public education in the state. Not everyone knows that. Back when we did the Northwest Territory, we divided up the plots of land, and we always saved a spot for a public school because that's what binds us. And like I said, in 70 counties, it's all we have. It is a part of the way of life. It is our neighbors and our friends who work there. And everywhere I go, in small towns and rural and in urban settings, everyone is concerned about this attack on public schools, our funding, which we finally had a bipartisan funding agreement that both sides agreed to. And I think it's imperative for our future as a state that we honor that.
The governor is now deciding whether to sign or veto Senate Bill 1, the Diversity and Equity and Inclusion bill that just passed in the Senate. It would also, you know, would eliminate those programs on college campuses and also prohibit faculty from striking. If you were governor, would you sign it or veto it?
You know, this is, and Governor and I can agree to disagree on a number of issues, but if I were governor, I would absolutely veto this bill, and I'll tell you why. First of all, this is terrible for our economy. We already know that we have the 45th level, we rank 45th in growth of GDP, and our biggest export is young people. This is dissuading businesses from coming to our state, some of these antics. It is definitely keeping students. You know, we attract tons of students from all over the country and, in fact, all over the world because we have some of the finest educational institutions. I will also say that this is the biggest threat to collective bargaining since Senate Bill 5. I think it is a travesty in that sense. And you mentioned diversity. Look, diversity is our strength, not our weakness. I will always see it that way. And this is a bill that I think is dangerous. And I hope, I really do hope the governor takes a long look at this and what it means for our state.
Vivek Ramaswamy has floated the idea of phasing out the state income tax. Where do you stand on tax relief for Ohioans, and what would you do?
I can tell you Ohioans all over are very, very concerned about costs. And one of the hidden reasons they have to be so concerned about costs is a lot of the special interests and antics that really rule everything at our state house and have taken us backwards. Really, in our entire adult lives, we've been going backwards on every measure. Property taxes are going up, but they're going up because we're not doing our job at the state house and funding things like school. When you do not fund programs, that pushes it back down to the locals. We've been taking money away from local communities. I'm very much about empowering local communities. Mm-hmm. But that then means they have to go to the ballot. They have to go to us for police and fire and education. So it's actually, and even the governor has said, we have done enough in lowering income taxes to attract businesses. What we have to do is make sure that we're funding, fully funding the work that Ohioans have asked us to do as public servants. And that is actually not sustainable. And Vivek is attacking both ends of the spectrum, but obviously that goes back to our safety and our fire and our police and our kids getting a good education.
Well, I know that there's a long way to go until the primary. Thank you so much for making time today to come in and express your views. I appreciate it.
Well, it's an honor, and it'll be an honor and a privilege to serve the people of Ohio.
Dr. Amy Acton.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
I got a chance to talk to a man who wants to be Ohio's next governor. Vivek Ramaswamy says he believes changes to the teacher pay structure could help solve education challenges. The Republican candidate for governor told me paying teachers based on merit will attract the best teachers to the state. Ramaswamy delivered the keynote address at the Asian American Commerce Group Summit. He told the crowd Ohio faces three great challenges in the next decade. First, improving the electric grid to handle power needs. Second, reversing what he calls the population crisis of more people moving out of the state than moving in. And finally, improving educational achievement. He says one way to do that is by paying teachers based on merit.
The average starting salary for a public school teacher in this state and across the country is around $45,000. It's unacceptable because it's not going to attract the very best into education. At the same time, how do we make sure that public school teachers are paid more? If we do it according to meritocracy, there's an opportunity to at once attract and reward the very best public school teachers. That's important to me. I'm a product of public education in this state, while at the same time making sure we're doing right by our students.
As I mentioned, Ramaswamy also calls Ohio's declining population a crisis. He wants to turn that around. And he says one way to do that is to phase out the state income tax.
Why do you think that would work? And what about paying for the vital services that income tax pays for?
Look, the fact of the matter is, I said we need to get to a zero income tax rate. What I said on day one is we need to bring down the income tax eventually down to zero. And the reason why is we need to be able to compete with eight other states that have done the same thing. You want to know one of the biggest problems in our state that nobody's talking about is that we have a population decline issue in the state of Ohio. We have more people moving out than in.
Ramaswamy says more people moving into the state would solve the worker shortage and the economic boom that would follow will cover a lot of the losses of eliminating the income tax. He says he would also work to cut areas where expenditures aren't really helping anyone today. He did not give specifics on that.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different. And not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
At the State House, a bill that has sparked controversy and protests has passed in the General Assembly. The Advance Ohio Higher Education Act is now heading to Governor Mike DeWine's desk. Senate Bill 1 passed in the state Senate by a vote of 20-11, with two Republicans joining Democrats in voting against it. The bill removes DEI programs from Ohio's colleges and universities and prevents faculty from striking. Supporters say it will increase diversity by moving discussions more to the center and including more conservative viewpoints.
Whether or not we have a say in what goes on in our universities, if we don't have a say, then the people don't have a say.
Instead of tackling the real barriers to higher education, skyrocketing tuition costs, student debt, again, the majority are focused on dictating what's taught in our colleges and universities and who teaches.
The bill would also decrease term limits for state school board of trustees and create a mandatory American civics course for students. Governor Mike DeWine says he will likely sign the bill, but is now reviewing the final version of it. 10TV asked him about his views on the bill.
I think there's been a concern that our college campuses sometimes are liberal. But I think the real concern should be, you know, are there situations where somebody who has a different point of view feels that they cannot express that point of view? And I think that's the real goal of that I see, at least, as I read this bill. You can be a liberal on a college campus, you can be a conservative, you can be whatever you want to be. That's the place where you have the free exchange of ideas. I remember when I was a kid in high school, William F. Buckley came to Antioch College and spoke. And I went there to watch it. It was fun to watch it. And they were all over him. But there was no one that said, he can't speak. There was no one said, oh, no, we got to get him out of here. He can't stand up there and speak. They respected the First Amendment. They respected the right of Buckley to speak. But then they got up and asked him very, very tough questions and argued with him. That's what we want to see. That's what we want to see is people learn how to debate, learn how to not only have an opinion, but have that opinion based upon some facts and have to back up that with facts. That's part of learning.
Again, that was courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. It was from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition of that program can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.